Remember the good old days before Microsoft Word had autosave? You'd type up some important document and then your computer would freeze and you'd lose hours of work just because you forgot to hit save? Well, that's what it's like going online without ExpressVPN. Every time you're connected to an unencrypted network, whether it's in an airport, a hotel, a cafe, or anywhere, your online data is not secure. Any person on that same network who knows what they're doing can gain access to your personal data. Bank logins, credit card details, passwords, all the stuff you don't want people seeing. Unfortunately, hacking has become much easier than it used to be. People don't even have to be exceptionally skilled to do it, and there's a lot of money to be made by selling your information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. It's incredibly easy to use. Once the app is running, you literally click one button to get protected. And it works on your phone, laptop, tablet, and more, so you can stay protected on the go. I've been using ExpressVPN for a little while now, and I can rest easy knowing my info is safe and secure. I've heard horror stories of people who've been hacked, and it sounds like a massive pain to try to get any resolution in the aftermath, so I am not interested in finding out what that process is like. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/film. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, June 24th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the weekend's box office numbers, and we're going to dive into the mailbag and answer a couple of listener questions. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan. So, man, we got to talk about Inside Out 2. Like, this movie just keeps on rolling, right?
Well, yeah, it was funny because I was looking at this weekend as one of the weekends that Hollywood had seemingly sort of abandoned this summer. And also up top, I apologize. I'm getting over a sinus infection, so if I got to clear my throat and stuff while I'm talking, I apologize. But that aside, you know, so we had like the Bike Riders open this weekend and you had the Exorcism open this weekend. And so like that seemed like small potatoes. Not so much. Up until last weekend, we hadn't had any movie that had opened to $100 million or more this year. And as we know, Inside Out 2 opened to $154.2 million. Well, the movie held like gangbusters. It made $100 million in its second weekend. Now, the finals have not officially hit the boards yet, but Deadline has reported that it did $101 million. So my concern is that it was going to go down a little bit, but it looks like it did clear $100 million in that second weekend. That being the case, it is now only the seventh movie in history to make $100 million or more in its second weekend at the domestic box office. And the last time this happened, Ben, was when Avengers Endgame came out in 2019. So the fact that we're talking at all about Avengers Endgame and the box office right now in a positive light is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's wild. I was wondering when the last time that happened. Avengers Endgame, that is, I mean, that's pre-pandemic, obviously. That's like, that's back in, I mean, 2019, I think you could say, was like the peak for the theatrical business, right? Like, there were so many movies.
Yeah, 2018, 2019 were both just like gargantuan years.
Yeah.
So just to give some idea. So Inside Out 2 is now, has the biggest second weekend ever for an animated movie. Beating the Mario Brothers movie last year, which did 92.3 in its second weekend. No movie that has made at least $100 million in its second weekend has ever made less than $600 million domestically at the box office. I think if we had at the beginning of the year said Inside Out 2 was going to make $600 million worldwide, we'd be happy with that. Mm-hmm. The fact that it's got a shot at that domestic, if not more than that, is crazy. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said. The other fascinating thing here is that Inside Out 2 only dropped 35% in its second weekend. The Avengers, Jurassic World, Black Panther, Avengers Infinity War, Avengers Endgame, and Star Wars The Force Awakens, all of the movies that had better second weekends, all opened to $200 million or more. So they all suffered bigger drops in their second weekends than Inside Out 2 did, which to me is the most fascinating stat in this whole thing. That is some demonstration of how well things are going.
I know you're not in the prognostication game, the prediction game, right? But like, do you think that the performance so far is like makes it a slam dunk $1 billion grosser based on the track that it's on?
Unless half of the theaters around the planet are eviscerated in some unforeseen alien invasion or some crazy thing, it's going to clear $1 billion by the 4th of July, probably.
Wow.
And I mean, that's when Despicable Me 4 comes out. So it's not even going to be close, because Disney has committed to a 100-day theatrical run for this movie. So to be clear, now here's the other thing here. Inside Out 2, as of this writing, has made $724.3 million worldwide in 9 days. It is now the highest grossing movie of the year worldwide after 9 days. It is going to make well over $1 billion. The question now is how much over $1 billion. And again, comparing it to Mario last year, it's pacing ahead of Mario, and Mario made more than $1.3 billion. So, I mean, you know, we're looking at, you know, now I will say this, not to get too ahead of ourselves. If Despicable Me 4 comes along and takes a real big chunk out of this at the beginning of July, then, and let's say Inside Out 2 slows down a lot by then, maybe it doesn't pass Mario, maybe it doesn't have as big of legs, but it seems impossible to me that this movie makes less than $1.3 billion at the way that it's going. Mm-hmm. So it will almost assuredly pass Incredibles 2 as Pixar's highest grossing movie ever. Incredibles 2 was $1.26 billion, I believe. Okay. So the fact that you're talking about this movie beating pre-pandemic Incredibles 2 is, and don't get me wrong, I love the original Inside Out, but there's a part of me that is like, it was hard for me to imagine like Inside Out being as like Inside Out 2 being as big of a deal as Incredibles 2. Does that make sense? I'm not saying anything. Yeah, I thought Inside Out 2 was a great idea. I thought, you know, good, glad this like becomes one of the franchises, but like it felt like the world was waiting for Incredibles 2, and they were. It was a huge movie. But the fact that Inside Out 2 post pandemic is going to do bigger, I mean, it's crazy to me. It's amazing, you know? So, I mean, it really is like, I'm not saying it's enough to wipe away all of the negativity that I've sort of corrosively developed over the first half of this year, but it's helping.
I was going to ask you about that, sort of like what your, I don't know, like a gut check moment of like, cause we did the whole, like the sky is falling thing. We've had that conversation a lot in the first half of 2024. And now that this movie is doing so well, so quickly, I think we knew it would do well, but the fact that it's doing so well, so fast, I'm wondering if that gives you any, I don't know, if that reframes your thinking about like this year as a whole, or, you know, even where we are in the summer season or anything like that. Cause the one other thing I'll say real quick before I let you answer is like, you mentioned Despicable Me 4 coming up and like, that movie probably taking a big chunk out of Inside Out 2. I think that is definitely going to happen, because you're talking about movies where the audience is like rabid for it. It seems like that is a franchise where the audience is just cannot get enough of Minions and Despicable Me and all that. So I'm guessing that movie is going to take a huge, huge chunk out of whatever Inside Out 2 is doing at that moment. But you know, the presumed success of that film combined with the outstanding success of Inside Out 2, what does that do to your mentality of where the box office is right now?
Well, just to give some context to listeners about the Despicable Me movies, because I know like a lot of older folks are like, ew, Minions. The lowest grossing movie in that franchise is still the original Despicable Me, which made $544 million worldwide. The highest grossing is 2015's Minions, which made $1.1 billion worldwide. 2022's Minions The Rise of Gru made $940 million. So, like, Despicable Me 4 is going to make a huge chunk. So, look, to more directly answer your question, and I brought up the Despicable Me stuff for a reason, we have another presumed hit, huge hit, coming right around the corner. Mm-hmm. You know, and then that'll be followed up by Deadpool and Wolverine, which is all I keep seeing is estimates going up and up and up for that. Like, it's you know, it's going to be huge. So, you know, here we are, we were going to have three just monsters back to back to back. And I think we're going to ultimately see that these will be the three movies that finish as the highest grossing movies of the year. Look, that's great. I think before Inside Out 2 came out, ticket sales domestically were pacing 26% behind 2023. Now that Inside 2 has come out and what it's done, ticket sales are now 21% where they were. So like,
wow,
it's
okay. That puts it in perspective.
Yeah. So it's helped, but again, ticket sales are still down 21%. We're not going to be able to make up that full 21% gap. Like, I just don't think so. So we're still going to finish the year behind where we were in 2023. That's not good, but maybe there's, you know, potential for momentum here, but I still think you can't erase my pessimism for something like the Fall Guy doing as badly as it did. Do I think the Fall Guy was ever a great idea? Do I think continuing to make franchises for franchise sake is a great idea? Do I think only making movies for old people instead of young people is a good idea? No. Do I still think that movie should have done better? Yes. Do I still think it sucks that in week five, Furiosa is at number 11 at the box office and shedding theaters like crazy? Yes. Like, some of these things are impossible to not have me think about. Mm-hmm. But do I, am I like thrilled to see a Pixar movie doing what a Pixar movie used to do? You bet I am. Like, that's so encouraging to me. Like, I felt so optimistic last year when Elemental had its turnaround. Like, Pixar to me has always been this special thing. And I don't say this as like some wide-eyed, you know, bushy-tailed child. Like, I say this as someone who loves cinema. You know, you look me in the eyes and tell me WALL-E's not cinema, you know, even though it's like technically a kid's movie. Like, I think Pixar is important. And I think it's good to me to see. So it does give me some optimism. It really does. But, you know, there's the other side of that equation where it is a sequel to an already successful movie doing well, not the original, you know? Yeah. And so like, that's nerve wracking. There's a lot of pressure on Elio to deliver next year. Now, I believe Pixar's next one after that, which hasn't been announced, is going to be an original as well, even though we don't know what that is. So the pressure is on for those to deliver. But if those deliver, relatively speaking, as well, I'm suddenly filled with optimism. You know, but and there's other things to talk about. The fact that Bad Boys Ride or Die only dropped 44% again this weekend, even though it lost 100 screens. So that movie's on the precipice of passing $300 million worldwide. And against a $100 million budget, if it didn't make any more money, anybody under pandemic circumstances says, if your blockbuster makes three times its budget worldwide, you should be happy. So, you know, the fact that that movie's now already in gravy territory after three weekends is great. You know, that's encouraging. So there are things that make me feel optimistic. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, in its seventh weekend, only dropped 35% even after shedding another 190 theaters. It is going to cross 400 million worldwide with tremendous legs. That stuff makes me feel encouraged. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's still things that happened earlier this year that can't be ignored. You know, one movie can't make up for systemic issues.
So what else from, I guess, the box office numbers overall, the picture of the box office this past weekend stood out to you in terms of something you just want to mention on today's episode?
I think really not to be lost in the conversation, because we're not going to get to talk about this a lot, is The Bike Riders, which was the other new movie that came out this weekend through Focus Features. It was Jeff Nichols' new movie, Austin Butler, Tom Hardy motorcycle movie, supposed to come out last year, kind of an award season play. Disney got cold feet. Sold it to Focus Features. My understanding is it was a $40 million movie, but Focus only paid about half of that to get it from Disney, because Disney just was like, we don't want to deal with this. So The Bike Riders made $10 million. On a weekend, now only it played in 2,600 theaters. Mind you, Inside Out 2 played in 4,400 theaters. So it played on a lot less theaters, and it still made $10 million. And I think for an original adult-driven drama like that, that's encouraging. On a summer weekend where it could have easily been buried by Garfield, Bad Boys, Inside Out, like all these things, it did cut through the noise. And is it going to be a huge hit? No, but it seems like the reception is positive, and an original movie in and amongst all these summer hits could, you know, leg out to very optimistically say 40, 45 million worldwide. That to me is encouraging. That sets it up for a good VOD run, a good streaming run. That's good news to me. So, like, again, if it doesn't fall off a cliff, you know, next weekend, like, that's good news. So I think, like, there are good things. And after spending the whole first of this year being a negative Nancy, and I apologize to the listeners for that, it is nice to have some good things to be happy about.
Yeah, I'm excited about The Bike Riders' performance because, you know, I think we both knew that that movie was never going to be some sort of gargantuan box office smash or anything. But there are plenty of movies that are just as good, if not better, than The Bike Riders, which is a great movie, by the way, that, you know, have just like come out and completely fallen in their face in their first weekend of the box office. So like
100%.
Yeah. So the fact that this didn't happen is ideal. And like you're saying, at least it sets it up for maybe a more sort of, I don't know, like a healthier long-term life than it could have had otherwise.
Yeah. A couple of quick things I'd also like to highlight. A movie called Thelma came out this weekend from Magnolia Pictures. Small distributor, not really ever going for big openings here. Thelma stars a 94-year-old June Squibb in her first ever leading role. And it made $2.2 million, came in at number 8 at the box office, made a respectable $1,700 per screen average. I just think that's really cool. The movie's got like a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes. It'll do well on streaming. People pick it up. But I think it's really neat that someone who's had such a long career is finally getting this like nice little time to shine in like this weird little action comedy. And I think that's super rad that kind of didn't just get completely buried.
Did you have a chance to see Thelma yet?
I still haven't had the chance. I'm dying to go see it, though. It looks so charming.
Yeah, it really is. I reviewed it from Sundance. I think it came out in Sundance earlier this year, back in January. And yeah, it's just like a really, really fun, crowd-pleasing movie. It's the kind of thing that you could bring a bunch of different age groups to. So if you have a family and you're looking for, I mean, maybe like the youngest kids might not love it, but it is one of those movies that like, it seems like everybody can sit around and watch together. So I would encourage people to go to the theater and check it out just because, it's just like a fun story. And the meta story of it all with the June Squibb starring and all that. I mean, her career has been amazing so far and since so long for her to finally be getting her flowers in this way. It's just really cool to see.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Also, one last thing I should highlight is Kinds of Kindness, the new Yorgos Lanthimos movie came out. Searchlight did a platform for this one, so it only opened in 5 theaters, but it made $350,000, meaning it had a $70,000 per screen average, which is almost as much as Poor Things did last year when it debuted similarly. Now, Poor Things went on to make over $100 million worldwide, got a Best Picture nomination, huge hit for that type of movie. So, this is an encouraging start. It would also mean if things go well and Kinds of Kindness can leverage this, success and word of mouth moving forward, that, it could be the third in a row hit for Yorgos and Emma Stone. Also of importance is that Kinds of Kindness is only a $15 million movie, so it's even cheaper than Poor Things was by quite a bit. So it doesn't even need to make as much. But yeah, this is like an encouraging start, and it's kind of looking like Yorgos Lanthimos is developing this following and sort of like guys like Christopher Nolan and Jordan Peele and some of these guys that their name means something. Starting to look like his name might mean something, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, especially considering like the straight up weirdness of a lot of his movies. Just the fact that audiences seem to be digging the particular brand of strangeness that he's putting out there is very encouraging, like on a, a cultural level or something. Just the fact.
It is. And it's also just like he seems to be making movies at a budget level that make enough sense for what the thing is. Which is good. Like if he can continue to do that and can continue to keep things like this going, I think that's great. So that's another thing to keep an eye on in the coming weeks, but good looking stuff there.
Excellent. Okay. So actually let's take a break and then we'll be back to talk about a few more box office things and we'll answer a couple questions in the mailbag. All right. So looking ahead, Ryan, to this week, A Quiet Place Day One, I think, is going to be the big release that people are probably going to be paying a lot of attention to. So what do you think about the prospects for that one?
Well, things are looking good. So the one thing I will say is that the first two A Quiet Place movies did exceptionally well for themselves. I'll always sort of be curious about A Quiet Place Part Two because it came out in that pandemic 2021 year, where it just... It did well, but it was a recovery year. Mm-hmm. So, A Quiet Place Part Two made $297 million worldwide against a $47 million opening. It was a lot more expensive than the first movie was. The first movie only cost $17 million to make. Quiet Place Part Two was $60 million. But that's still a huge hit on a $60 million budget. So people like these movies a lot. Now, the... early look at A Quiet Place Part Two. The tracking has been Quiet Place Part One. Day One. I'm sorry that these titles screw me up, but it's currently looking at anywhere between like a $42 and $51 million opening, which would put it in the same range as A Quiet Place Part Two. That would be great for a prequel with none of the returning cast for the most part. Yeah, and the budget hasn't been revealed yet, but I'm assuming Paramount wouldn't give this like a $100 million budget. So I'm assuming it's probably in the same range. Hopefully it's under 70 would be my hope for it. But yeah, so really what it's probably looking like is this is going to be our first outright breakout horror hit of the year. We've had very little mainstream horror success this year. So this is going to be the first one that, you know, really breaks out. And with an opening like that, it should have no problem getting to 200 worldwide, if not a lot more. So yeah, I think it's looking good. And the full reviews haven't come out yet, but the early word on Twitter has been very good. The critical reactions have been very kind to it. So it doesn't look like, you know, it's like a disaster that's going to, like, you know, mess up the franchise or anything. So,
oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it really does look encouraging. I mean, like, to the horror point, we didn't talk about it much, but the Exorcism, the new Russell Crowe movie, opened, and it opened to like just over $2 million this weekend. It got a D Cinema score, you know, like, it's so, like, you know, that flopped this past weekend. So, like, you know, but so now we're finally going to have like a big horror hit this year, which is nice. It's just a matter of, can it propel after that opening weekend? How good's the word of mouth? You know, those are always the questions. But to start, it looks like Paramount really is going to be able to leverage the success of those first two entries into a successful prequel. And kind of against all odds, I think they've managed to turn this into a franchise, because after that first one, I was really unsure of how that was going to go. But
yeah,
they've done a good job with it. And I will say that first one was my favorite movie of that year. I was shocked I liked the sequel as much as I did. I'm encouraged by the early word here. And, you know, if you can get me on board with these, I imagine you can get a lot of other people on as well. So good for them.
Yeah, I think we've talked about how the box office is in desperate need of a big horror hit. And I'll be happy to see it if that comes true for A Quiet Place Day One. So we'll report back on that next week. Okay, let's get into the mailbag. Dalton from Seattle wrote in response to the conversation that you and I were having about renting movie theaters. And Dalton says, we have a theater in Seattle that does just what you two are describing. A few years ago, some friends and I rented out the Beacon Theater here in Seattle. It is a small, very fun vintage theater with one screen. They serve candy, popcorn, beer, and wine. They offer an amazing service where you can request an old film, and they will track down the digital film print of the movie to screen for you. We watched the original Ghostbusters movie. It was such a blast. It's such a cool business idea. I'm hoping to rent it out and request the original 90s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles sometime in the near future. Thought you guys might get a kick out of that. So thank you for writing in, Dalton. That does sound awesome. I wish I had a theater around me that did something similar. Ryan, do you know if there's anything around you that has like that level of, I guess, like audience choice to it?
Well, the one thing I brought up last time, we have the Blue Starlight Drive-In out here, and shout out to Josh Frank, who the owner there, nothing as legendary as the Beacon Theater. I mean, you know, the Beacon Theater is, you know, nation renowned. Like that's a landmark. But yeah, I mean, you can, like, I know Josh does rentals and you can pick things out and does stuff like that. So I know there are places that do that, but I think they're generally smaller, more independent own type places rather than like a chain. Mm-hmm. Man, that's cool that you can do that at the Beacon. That's really rad. Yeah. Man, oh my God, seeing the 90s Ninja Turtles on that would be so rad.
Yeah, I put a link to the Beacon Theater's website in the show notes for this episode. So if anybody here is listening from Seattle or is about to visit the Seattle area and wants more information about that, you can track that down there. All right, Ryan, there's one other email that I wanted to get to, and this is finally circling back around to the rest of the email that was written in a long time ago by Wes from Dallas-Fort Worth. And we addressed, I think that was the conversation that kicked off this whole thing, the email that kicked off this entire conversation about renting out theaters that. So let's see. There are multiple points to address from Wes's email. First, he wants to know, Ryan, why the world of box office reporting does not always take inflation into account when comparing past data to current data. Do you know why that is?
Well, there are a few reasons. I will say, if you read my Tales from the Box Office column, I do tend to try to do that for historical, particularly with budgets and stuff. Cause like, you know, when you read that, like Tim Burton's Batman was made for like $35 million, or 48, whatever it was, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it would have been like, you know, $120 million budget by today's standards. So things like that are important to sort of take into account. But I think more than anything, part of the reason I don't always do it is, really, it's always all about relativity to itself. And so, you know, a $200 million movie probably needs to make about $600 million worldwide to be a success, give or take. So I'm just sort of focusing on the relativity of that time. And then also as far as like just as far as the business of writing about this stuff goes, if you can say that a movie broke a certain record in a headline or something like that, and not having to make the caveat that it's unadjusted for inflation or all these things, it's just not as easy to cram into a headline or, you know, as a talking point. You know, and the other thing too is inflation's and that is one metric from those times, but movies used to also play in theaters for a lot longer, so they also had an advantage of running longer. So, you know, it's like comparing what a movie made in, you know, 1985 to what a movie could make in 2025 is apples to oranges, truly. Yeah. Yes, there is inflation to take into account, but I think the relativity is always true, that a movie has a certain amount spent on it and it needs to make a certain amount to be profitable. And I think the day-to-day box office reporting is still, that's still true. And yes, sometimes you can be like, yeah, sure. Maybe Avatar is still the highest grossing movie of all time, but it's probably true that Star Wars sold more tickets in its day. You know what I mean? Like you can go over those things, but it doesn't make the raw number any less impressive and some of that stuff. But yeah, it really depends on what you're talking about, why you're talking about it. And it gets a little tricky, but, you know, certain people are better about talking about it. I will say that, but,
yeah,
it's not an attempt to be misleading or anything. It just, you know, sometimes it's relevant. Sometimes it's not as relevant.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, Wes, one of the other points that they wanted addressed in this email was, why is there such a focus on dollars and not the number of tickets sold? And that's the kind of thing you just mentioned with like the original Star Wars, that obviously like a ton of tickets were sold compared to the number of tickets sold has dropped precipitously in the decades since then. But I guess like, is there a reason? I don't know. I know you speak with a lot of other box office reporters and you guys have, you know, your own conversations and stuff. I was just wondering if there's like sort of a, I don't know, an agreed upon wisdom as to why the number of tickets sold is not really a thing that's brought up very often. Or
this one's easy to answer. It doesn't matter. Okay. if someone bought a $1 billion ticket to a movie, it's in profits. It doesn't really and that's an extreme example, but I say this to be like, look, Oppenheimer didn't really sell as many tickets as Barbie overall, but it sold a hell of a lot of IMAX tickets, which are much more expensive. So like ultimately the value proposition is the same at the end, right? Like in that consumers decided that this movie was worth $1 billion of their money. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was worth more premium tickets to those consumers, but it's still the same number. Like an IMAX ticket is not the same as a Tuesday discount ticket. So, you know, that's another apples to oranges thing, right? Like, but at the end of the day, as far as the business is concerned, and if you're writing about box office, you're ultimately writing about the business of the movie business. So that number is what's important. Profit is what's important. And, you know, that's what matters. And yeah, so that to me is that's why the number of tickets sold is not, even just for me as someone who finds this stuff interesting and has chosen to make his career about it. You know, I think it is interesting that like, you know, IMAX and premium formats can drive other movies to be more successful, even if they did sell less tickets. That's actually an interesting, you know, part of this to me. But I think that ultimately, yeah, it is that raw number at the end of the day is why. And because, yeah, matinees are cheaper than later shows. And there's all these things like counting the tickets doesn't tell the whole story. That number to me is still the more honest representation of how a movie did, I guess. Gotcha. Is what I would say.
Okay. And then speaking of premium, Wes says, I wouldn't mind paying a premium to go to the movies, but it would have to come with a premium experience. And right now it just isn't so. What would that mean for people with lower incomes? Unfortunately, it seems like we're approaching a point where a premium experience may not even be possible if studios can't justify making enough movies for theaters to exist. Assuming movie theaters start closing down, what outlook do you see 10 years from now if things don't change? Will going to the movies be like going to the opera with limited showings only on specific dates and very expensive tickets? What changes would you make to fix the industry? I know you've thought a lot about this, Ryan. I was just wondering if you had anything like locked and loaded as like a go-to answer for, I don't know, any changes that you could, you know, if you were in charge, if Mr. Hollywood came by and gave you the keys to the city and gave you the ability to implement sweeping change across all these movie studios, is there anything that you would do immediately to maybe try to get the industry rightened again?
Well, Wes Redding from Dallas. Wes, if you're listening, I do know that all of your Alamo Draft House is just closed, and I apologize for that. But I will say, I think that a lot of the industry is focusing on what they would consider to be a premium experience. The Alamo Draft House, which I go to all the time, I was just there yesterday, is generally a better screen, better projection, better seat, better service. And then you pay for maybe a cocktail, you pay for better food than you would get at like an AMC. So you can sort of pay for what level of premium you want, if that makes sense. And then iPick and some of these other smaller chains have a similar model. I think that's something. And then I think we just talked about IMAX, Dolby Cinema, some of these others, which are premium as far as the actual projection, sound, light, all that stuff. That's premium. And I think IMAX would tell you that, you know, that premium experience is working for them. So I think that's something. And we've seen that people are willing to pay for that premium experience. I don't think that can be the whole answer, though. I tend to agree with Sony's Tom Rothman here, which is that we need to make movie going more of a regular thing. It almost needs to be like the opposite of a premium experience sometimes, like where it can just be something if you have $10 in your pocket and you want to go waste a Wednesday evening, you just go to the movies. So I think we need to make that element of it accessible. I think you could argue that maybe like there are just too many theaters in parts of the country and not enough in others. And I think maybe like, you know, if AMC just closed a bunch of its theaters and maybe there was some reorganization and, you know, there were theaters better positioned in certain parts of the country and, you know, like that maybe you have fewer theaters, but they're positioned better where like you can better serve the audiences in that area. I do think there's going to be some contraction in that way. Mm-hmm. So I think that, yeah, but I think what Wes is ultimately asking about, is it going to be opera? Is it going to be like that sort of limited type of premium experience? The industry as it exists can't function if that ends up being what it is. So you would need to at least have a semblance of, you know, a nationwide, you know, box office type thing to be able to continue to have Hollywood exist as it currently exists. Yeah. So I doubt that it'll go that far, but I do think there's going to be an element of, for the bigger movies, it's going to rely on these more premium experiences, popcorn buckets, all these other things. And then I think your average day-to-day stuff is going to rely on, you know, somehow making it more affordable and reinvesting in the habit of movie going. The industry at large is going to have to figure that one out. But
yeah,
that's kind of my best thing, is I think there's going to be some contraction, but I think there might be a way to do some strategic reorganizing to make it so things can still function better.
Yeah, I think contraction's a big thing. I think also, I would not be surprised if 10 years from now, there's even more contraction in the actual studio system as it exists right now. Like the, you know, the idea that I think we're down to 5 major studios right now in Hollywood. Yes. I wouldn't be surprised if 10 years from now, we're down to, you know, 2 or 3 or something. Like, that's bleak. But if things don't change, which is how Wes framed this question, then that is, I don't know, it seems to be like a likely outcome, you know? So that's not great, certainly, not what I would want to see, but I kind of like embracing myself mentally for that, those kinds of announcements coming in the years to come, is just, you know, we're about to, like, there's still a lot of questions about what's going on with Paramount right now and who's going to end up buying it and all of that kind of stuff. But like, for me, as somebody who cares a lot about Hollywood history, one of my biggest questions with that is, what is going to happen to the Paramount lot? Like, I used to be a tour guide on the Paramount lot, and
no shit.
Still, yeah. There's so much history in that space and in those sound stages and, you know, walking around where Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn used to walk around, like all of that kind of stuff. Like, what happens to that land, you know? Like, and so those things that mean a lot symbolically to me and people like me, I don't know, like business wise, I'm not sure what's going to happen to stuff like that. And that's the kind of like more bleak look at what might happen if things don't change. But yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think about this before we started recording, Ryan, and then like, you know, you've got companies like Amazon and Apple that don't necessarily play by the same rules as the rest of the major studios. We've talked about that with in terms of like them financing big projects like Killers of the Flower Moon and Napoleon and things like that. But like, we know that the future is streaming, like that's not going away anytime soon. But we also know that that's not a profitable model. And most of the major studios have, if not all of them by now, have come back around to the idea of like, oh, we actually need to release things theatrically. So I don't know. I guess that's what you were saying when you're saying like Hollywood as we know it today, you know, can only exist if these certain things happen. But I wonder what it looks like if the Hollywood that we know today goes away and it morphs into something else. Like, do you have any thoughts about what it could morph into and the importance or lack thereof of theatrical in that kind of a situation?
It either gets much bigger or much smaller, right? Like, you either have like, you know, it comes down to like Disney and one other studio that survive, right? Like, those are the old Hollywood studios or whatever. But then I also think that there's going to be a desire for people to be able to make films outside that system. So I think what you might have is more like Magnolia's, A24s of the world try to spring up, or even smaller companies like that, that like are just like, we're going to try to cobble together money to make things. And maybe they go smaller. Maybe it goes the, you know, Kevin Smith like route where you're just, you know, going around the country showing your movie and, you know, you made it cheaply and maybe you can barely make enough, you know, maybe like some semblance of semi-independent cinema springs up that way. Like, you know, mm-hmm. And there is it's like you have two extreme ends where you have the small number of big movies produced by the couple of studios that remain, along with all of these other smaller players trying to just, you know, put more stuff into the marketplace. Maybe that's where it ends up. That's a possibility. But I just think that like movies won't culturally go away. It's just that like things are going to change a lot. We're just in that we are literally living in the most uncertain period right now. Like 2 years from now, we're going to look back and be like, oh yeah, this all makes more sense. But right now we are living in the uncertainty. So It's like, you know, we can point and guess, but like, we just got to see where the dust settles.
Yes, for sure. Well, thank you to Wes for writing in. Sorry it took us so long to get around to answering the questions in your full email. Thank you to Dalton from Seattle for writing in as well. If you guys want to send us a message, any sort of feedback, questions, comments, concerns, other mailbag topics, you can email us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. So that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find much more about all the stuff that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.